All right, everybody, welcome back to another awesome episode of the Crypto 101 podcast, where we speak to founders, CEOs, and the smartest people building up the Bitcoin, blockchain, and crypto industry. Today's episode is brought to you by our sponsor, P-Tokens and P-Network. And if you've been listening to Crypto 101 for any amount of time, you've heard us call 2020 the year of interoperability. Over and over again, we're talking about this concept, and that's because the smartest teams in crypto are all focused on bridging the divide between the many different cryptocurrencies. So, imagine in the future, you won't have to worry about managing a million different addresses for your Bitcoin and your Ethereum and Litecoin and Tezos and EOS and all that stuff, right? Rather, you'll be able to send any crypto to any address at any time. Well, that future is here, and it's made possible by P Network's P Tokens. And the ticker symbol for that is PNT. So beyond that, P Tokens are able to be staked with a 42% annual yield. Wow. So that means if you stake 1,000 tokens, by the end of the year, you would have earned an additional 420 tokens. I mean, that is serious business, and it's a great way to be earning passive income. So if you want to learn more about the P Network, the leading protocol enabling interoperability, or how you can earn 42% annual yield on your P tokens, click the link in our show notes or go to www.p.network. Again, that's www.p, as in the letter P, dot network. Before we dive in to our awesome, awesome guest and conversation today, I want to remind you guys of two things. And the first one is that if you go to crypto101insider.com, you can join our private community. Here's where we have our model portfolio and all of our top picks. We also have Crypto 101 University, where we have hours and hours and hours of written and video content that explains blockchain and explains cryptocurrency in a very bite-sized and easy to understand way. And we have a weekly newsletter that goes out and quarterly state of crypto addresses that go out. There is just a ton of value packed into this every which way. So I want you guys first to go to crypto101insider.com today, if you haven't already. I also want to remind you guys that Pizza Mind and I recently just finished a book. It took 11 months of our lives to write, and we're calling it Crypto Revolution, Your Guide to the Future of Money. We walk you through this fascinating world of cryptocurrencies and blockchain, and it's part history book, it's part instructional guide, and it's going to really show you guys why cryptocurrencies are globally disruptive and how they're going to actually change in real life and in real terms the way that we buy and sell and even live. We include a bunch of how-tos on getting started with your first exchanges. We give you tips on, you know, how to safely buy and sell and store cryptocurrencies, as well as how do we evaluate potentially good cryptocurrencies. And the best part of the book is that we're giving it away for free. All you have to do is pay for shipping and handling. So go to cryptorevolution.com and pick up your copy today. All right, all of you good, wonderful citizens of Crypt Nation. I hope you're having a wonderful morning, noon, or night, because wherever you are in the world, Pizza Mind, what do we tell these folks?
Well, we tell them they're in the right place, but I'm not sure in 2020 anymore. we're all trying to get back to the right place, wherever that may be. But in the meantime, hunker down, do whatever you have to do to survive.
The price of Bitcoin seems to be in the right place, or at least it's headed towards the right place. You know, we're recording this episode here late November, broke out at 17K for the first time really since 2017. And it's just been a very, very interesting time. But we're going to get into some very interesting and heady stuff here today. We're going to break down some economics behind crypto. We are joined by Garrick Heileman of blockchain.com, who is their head researcher, and he's also a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics. So folks, pause this and go get a notepad and a piece of paper, because class is in session. Garrick, welcome to Crypto 101, baby.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. It's a pleasure to be here, and hopefully a more interesting session than the classes your audience remembers from university, if they've successfully escaped the clutches of academia.
You know,
we've all blocked that horrible memory out of our minds, except for the good parties at San Diego State. I can assure you that
the crazy thing, just to jump right into it, about academia is it's broken. Like, why didn't we ever learn how to balance a checkbook? Why didn't we learn about, you know, why, like, there's no practical stuff, it seems like, going through academia. I don't know. What do you think about that? How do you think of the future of academia?
Yeah, you know, that's a great place to start and one of my favorite topics because, you know, I have to, at the start of my lectures, you know, begin with kind of a what is money discussion because this is not taught, even in economics 101 classes, let alone high school, where money comes from. Most people, even people working in finance, can't really explain where money comes from and you know, how it's manufactured, so to speak. A lot of people have this sense, okay, the Fed, Federal Reserve is involved, but the vast majority of our money is not minted by the Fed or the government in the form of paper and coins. The vast majority of our money, and most people don't know this, is actually lent into existence by banks, you know, 90% or more in many countries. And so I always start a lot of my lectures with that. Because you can't really understand crypto, I think, until you understand where money comes from.
Yeah, no, it's super fascinating. And in fact, you know, I remember in the early days, maybe 5 years ago or so, when I was just beginning to learn about crypto and blockchain and how all this stuff comes together, you know, I saw a presentation, I learned about fractional reserve banking. And this was a concept, you know, I had gone all the way through college, right? And I had studied all sorts of stuff. I didn't even know that this was a thing. And it's something that I think a lot of people don't really understand. People don't know the history of money. People don't know how all that started. So, you know, after that, me and Pizza Mind, Aaron over here, we actually ended up going on to write a book called Crypto Revolution. We start with like the history of money. And so it's just very interesting. But, I want to talk to you personally kind of about your journey because you've got an interesting journey. Blockchain.com is, you know, one of the biggest providers of wallets. London School of Economics, obviously one of the, you know, the most reputable and acclaimed universities in the world. So how did you find your way into the areas of expertise that you currently are in?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Only in hindsight does my career make any sense whatsoever. You know, I can thank Satoshi Nakamoto for actually, you know, helping me make sense of this tangled path I've taken. So I started in investment banking, working in financial services, doing M&A, you know, kind of, you know, analyst type work. And then I worked in tech. I'm old enough to have been through the first dot-com bubble. I co-founded a tech incubator that invested in internet companies. And then a few other things happened, but the financial crisis occurred. And I said, I need to understand what's going on with the macro economy. I've always been very interested in econ. Minored in college and went to go do the PhD at the LSE. And it was during that time, one of my PhD supervisors was Neil Ferguson, who's a noted monetary historian. It was during that time that I first learned about Bitcoin, kind of on my own. I saw the story on, I think it was Gawker maybe, about the Silk Road in 2011. And at that time, I was studying black market currencies. And I just kind of, what is this thing called Bitcoin? Does it fit into my framework that I was developing for how to classify different types of currencies? And I think the thing that really helped me grok Bitcoin much more quickly than folks like Neil, my advisor, who, I explained this to a number of times and he didn't quite get on board with it. But a lot of other economists famously also were very dismissive, is I had that tech background from Silicon Valley. And I saw this for more than just kind of gold standard 2.0. It was a lot more. There's a lot more to crypto and Bitcoin than just, we're going back in time and trying to reinvent the gold standard with a digital kind of like fig leaf. So that tech training, I think, was really helpful for me kind of wrapping my heads around it earlier than a lot of my economics colleagues. And makes me a little different than I think a lot of other, you know, academic economists who, many of which, surprisingly, are not very tech savvy, sadly.
That makes a lot of sense. So as you're studying economics, did you fall under any particular school of thought, either the Keynesian economics or the Hayek economics, or do you have your own lens that you formulated? And would you mind describing what those terms are?
Yeah. So, yeah, they can kind of be compared to religions in some ways. And I think one of the incredible, I think, stories that come out of the financial crisis, I think that illustrates this point well, is when the Queen of England came to the London School of Economics after the financial crisis, after the Lehman bankruptcy, and all the economists, you know, some of the best economists in the world were there. And she asked them directly, how come none of you saw this coming? You know, you guys are supposed to be the smartest, you know, economists in the world. And economists famously did not have very real world practical expertise to help assess something like the 2008 crisis. And, you know, the type of research that I was very inspired by was the work of folks like Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff and their great magisterial 2010 book, This Time is Different. It's the only, to my knowledge, best selling academic economic history book. So I went into the LSE's economic history program intentionally. They actually are one of the few schools, I think with the University of Glasgow, if I'm not mistaken, one of only two schools that actually has an economic history department, because that subject has been so deprioritized. That empirical work that economic historians are very famous for has been deprioritized by academic journals and departments at the top universities that favor theory and, you know, elegant mathematics and frankly, you know, the type of work that often is accused of having a lot of physics envy, that doesn't have any use, frankly, in the real world. And I think the 2008 crisis kind of laid bare just how inadequate macroeconomic models were for helping us understand what's actually happening. Whereas history and the empirical work of folks like Carmen and Ken and Neil and others, I think has actually been quite useful.
So a lot of us remember back in 2008 and 2009 when the mortgage industry kind of blew up, and that was kind of the catalyst to everything shutting down. But my question isn't about like what went wrong. My question is more about what like materially changed when what changed after that? Where are we coming out of that? Was it, you know, I know that we had more money printed and stuff like that, but you know, what really changed after the financial crisis?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think we're still trying to figure that out, you know, in detail. I think, some things that changed have been undone. Some of the Dodd-Frank, you know, rules were kind of wound back. The Volcker rule was softened. So you saw
what were those rules?
So they were rules designed to try to build in additional safeguards to prevent systemic collapse. The Volcker rule specifically was about preventing banks from trading aggressively and putting their institutions, these too big to fail institutions, at risk. One thing that did not change is too big to fail. We're too bigger to fail. Banks have gotten bigger. And again, you know, they're maybe not as, you know, freewheeling as they once were. Capital ratios are, you know, improved to some degree. For example, that may be a positive. That's certainly some, you know, something that, you know, professors like Nadamati at Stanford really advocated aggressively for. And we've seen some progress on that. But again, what attracted me to crypto and blockchain technology was this idea that, you know, regulatory changes post-crisis could be undone. Cultural and social changes, like, you know, we saw with things like Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street, trying to change kind of the political climate, those evaporated. But infrastructure changes, actual changes to the software, the DNA of the financial system, which blockchain, in my mind, represented a possibility around, that sounded like something that could be more long lasting and more permanent, and was part of the reason I was so interested in this and wrote about it, started writing publicly about it in 2013.
I think that you actually ended up exactly where I wanted you to end up, because at the, you know, in 2008, you know, Bitcoin was just a white paper. And now we have kind of like a safety raft almost. And we've seen empires rise and fall throughout history. But really, you know, what happens when an empire falls? And do you think that, you know, America is on the brink of an empire failing?
Wow, we're going into some light subjects here, aren't we? Well, okay, I think a lot of how a question like that can be answered depends upon the speed or rate of change and whether something happens suddenly, which can be, I think, sometimes more dangerous than if something happens over a longer stretch of time. And one of the things that has concerned me about the amazingness, for lack of a better word, of crypto is it's so compelling that I worry about too speedy a transition to a blockchain-based or crypto financial system. If that happened too quickly, you know, could that trigger the mother of all financial crises? And, you know, I always get a lot more nervous personally about the price of crypto going up too quickly than when it goes down fast. Because, you know, you worry about this idea that somehow this could destabilize the whole world if there was a huge run on the traditional financial system that happened like that. Now, that may be a really exciting possibility for many folks, and I don't want to rain on anyone's parade by expressing that view. But I think slow and steady has a much greater chance of kind of winning the race if you do believe in kind of substituting in new financial plumbing via blockchain technology with the existing plumbing than something that's so rapid that invites a very major backlash, not just by regulators, but by everyday folks in the street who just aren't equipped to kind of get on this life raft. There's, you know, a lot of awareness of Bitcoin. Over 80% of people know about it. But, you know, we think maybe 5% of people own it roughly. You know, it's a small segment of society that has kind of joined this quote unquote life raft to date.
From your vantage point, is the current financial system in the trouble it's in because it was a bad system from the beginning, or is it because people aren't following the rules and no one's enforcing the checks and balances?
Yeah, I think it's too simplistic to say it's a bad system. And I think you see evidence that many parts of it have merit in how they're being replicated in the crypto alternative financial system. If you look at, for example, the crypto lending space, which blockchain.com is very active in, you know, you see, you know, borrowing and lending occurring. And you know, is that a bad thing? You know, it can be, you know, it certainly can have negative outcomes and consequences, but it doesn't always have to be a bad thing. I mean, the whole idea behind lending is it allows us to bring the future forward into the present. And that can be a nice thing for accelerating, you know, growth, income, et cetera. Certainly there has been a huge violation of rules. You know, I for years in my lectures would use the John Corzine example of MF Global. This is the former head of Goldman Sachs, former governor of New Jersey, senator, you know, about as distinguished a member of the elite as you can get, who in essence, basically unbeknownst to MF Global's customers, took their money and gambled on European sovereign debt and blew up MF Global. And that was a violation of rules that could happen because of the lack of transparency that MF Global's customers had and regulators had into MF Global. So I think one of the promises of blockchain technology also is the ability to give customers, regulators more visibility in the financial system so that it's just not even possible to violate the rules in the way that John Corzine did at MF Global.
I love it. The next kind of topic I want to spend a little bit of time on is debt. And a lot of people have a negative connotation around debt. Debt's bad, don't get debt, all that stuff. But the fact is that, you know, the world wouldn't be where it is without debt, without mortgaging away the future, without having financing options available and stuff like that. But it, you know, in the Bitcoin cryptocurrency world, we say that these assets are debtless. So there seems to be some type of discrepancy here where we could is a future possible without debt and financing? And can you kind of talk a little bit about your views there on an economy that's been built on debt to an economy that is looking at maybe no debt?
Right. So, I mean, we have crypto debt. There's debt in the crypto space. And March was a very kind of scary time, I think, for a lot of people. because of how much leverage and debt had built up and continues today to exist in the crypto economy. When you get over leveraged, it's that you can have the Wile E. Coyote moment where you're out off the cliff and, you may not even know it for a moment. And then all of a sudden the bottom drops out. That's the problem with leverage, right? And I've seen this through the years. People get really aggressive and excited during moments like this. They start borrowing on the credit card. They start mortgaging their house even, and going all in. Because boy, I just know Bitcoin's going to hit a new all-time high. I'm 100% sure of it. How could it not? And maybe it even does. But can you get out, in time if that's your strategy? Exchanges fail. This space is still very new and immature. We still have. I don't want to bash on a competitor, but they're been a hugely positive influence in my view for crypto adoption. So I'll sing their praises first before I lament the fact that Coinbase still in 2020 crashes.
It went down yesterday.
I mean, this has been going on for how many years? And it's traditionally been a bullish indicator, like, oh, Coinbase is crashing. They're the primary on-ramp for new money, new retail. That's a great sign. But I mean, come on. I mean, I don't think that's anything for the industry to celebrate, or feel good about that, arguably the flagship, company in the space that might IPO and bring a whole new cohort of Wall Street institutional retail traditional money on board to crypto is still breaking down, and it's so I guess the point I'm trying to make is it's still, something where you need to be careful. And I guess to bring it back to debt, I think debt isn't inherently a bad thing. David Graeber passed away recently, wrote a brilliant kind of book on this subject. Debt predates money arguably, and how we form human relations. And, it's a complicated subject, but I don't think it's going away, number one. And number two, I think it can be used responsibly in a constructive way. The trick is when people get over exuberant, borrow Alan Greenspan's term, and just over leverage. So I think debt will continue to be a part of the crypto economy and the global economy.
Speaking of looking in the future of the global economy, I'm starting to see a phrase pop up over and over again at different places, whether it's from American politicians all the way up to the website of the International Monetary Fund. It's talking about the Great Reset. Have you heard of this? And if so, what have you heard that this might actually be?
So I don't know that I'm familiar with, the use of that term by IMF officials. You might be able to help me out here. Have notable IMF officials like Christine Lagarde and others actually made that term?
I haven't got a direct quote from them in this speech, but there's text on the website that mentions the Great Reset as one of their 10-year objectives or something like that.
Yeah, I would need to look at that to understand what the IMF is referring to there, because I think they would be very cautious, knowing folks at the IMF, about using such a term without really clearly explaining what they meant.
That's the thing. There's no definition as to what this is. It's just they're kind of floating this out here as like this weird alpha coming soon to a theater near you before we seize it. I don't know what it is. So
yeah, I saw a commercial on it the other day.
I don't and I was feel like, so bad if about not knowing about it if you don't know about it.
So I think you'll hear this term often mentioned around debt sustainability. And, the IMF was, I think, correct in calling out the Europeans, for example, a number of years ago, that the Greek debt was unsustainable. You need to reset that debt. This is ridiculous, that you can't have an honest conversation with yourselves and acknowledge that Greece is never going to, pay this off, in full, and you need to reset it. So that could mean something around debt sustainability. Certainly, it could mean something more dramatic than that for the global economy, the global monetary system. I think a term like that is potentially quite subversive, and I would be surprised if it gets widely used by, you know, current policymakers because of its potential connotations for a radical disruption of the status quo. A lot of what policymakers want to do is maintain the status quo, right? That's why the Federal Reserve is not anxious to embrace a digital dollar. They're kind of being dragged along. The status quo is working just fine for the Federal Reserve with the U.S. dollar so dominant and, you know, everything in orbit around the Fed and the U.S. and New York and the U.S. financial system. But, you know, China and other things are conspiring to kind of force the Fed to have to kind of upgrade, so to speak, to a digital dollar. Part of the concern may be that China risks resetting the global monetary landscape and replacing the dollar in places like Africa as the primary trade currency and reserve currency.
Interesting. Can you talk a little bit more about Greece in particular? You mentioned that for a second. How would Greece reset their debt? Do they have to just wipe out their currency and start with a brand new one? Or how does that even work?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And this is gets into kind of what I was working on during my PhD, where I was looking at debt sustainability specifically and thinking through, you know, how do you sustain a debt? You know, the way that people prefer to get out of a debt problem like Greece's problem is to grow their way out of it. Hence, they borrow money from the IMF, try to like kickstart growth. When you reset debt, typically, I think what you're talking about is some kind of default, in essence. It goes by other names. In the Greek crisis specifically, it was kind of laughable how many different terms they came up with to avoid having to use the word default. We're going to reprofile Greek debt. We're going to there was just
restructure.
Restructure. Yeah, I actually have this in my paper because it was just like comical how many different terms. Because if you use the word default, that can trigger, you know, debt covenants and so on. So they had to actually stay away from that language, interestingly. But really, it involves, I think, in essence, some kind of like, you know, writing down officially the nominal amount of debt that is owed. And that just was not politically palatable in Europe, still today, even really, because, you know, sovereign debt is supposed to be a zero risk asset. It's something you can pledge to the ECB, you know, is a risk free, you know, collateral. And, you know, as soon as it's not, then that whole myth, you know, the emperor's new clothes is exposed, right? Can't go there.
Yeah, he has no clothes at that point. Interesting. And this is one that we didn't really talk about in the outline that we sent over, but what you're talking about of like devaluing the nominal value of debt, is that kind of what's going on right now between America and China? They're kind of both in a race to devalue their currency so that they could devalue their debts that they owe one another. It's almost like a race to who could get to the bottom first.
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, we know that the U.S. is very pro weakening the U.S. dollar, at least, you know, the Trump administration certainly has been. And that helps make U.S. exports more competitive, you know, makes Chinese, you know, exports less competitive. And there's, I think it's interesting to kind of mention a quote from a central banker who will go nameless, talking about this kind of like, you know, kind of race around devaluing currencies. You know, a central banker one time told me that, you know, basically everything will be fine as long as we central bankers all hold hands and jump off the cliff together. And so what he meant by that basically is look, you know, there's nowhere to run, there's nowhere to hide. If, you know, the Europeans, the Americans, the Japanese central bank are all moving in unison and coordinating. And that's what's changed in the last decade, I think, is really, you know, gold's been there for centuries, you know, millennia as an alternative, but it's, you know, we wrote a research report in June kind of comparing Bitcoin and gold. You know, Bitcoin offers a really compelling alternative to gold in a number of ways, including its potential use as a currency, which gold really is difficult to use as a currency. And now you do have somewhere to run, somewhere to hide that could serve as a check on, you know, this kind of race to the bottom, you know, and may help police, you know, that kind of race to a bottom, so to speak. And I think that's a really interesting kind of development that crypto offers. What that means, I think, is going to be quite interesting, right? Like in some ways, Bitcoin is like, you know, imagine you're in a country that is at risk of dollarizing. You know, let's take Costa Rica, for example. 50% of all transactions are in the US dollars in Costa Rica. You as a central banker of Costa Rica are kind of in this race to compete against the US dollar and the risk of the dollar overwhelming your local currency. You know, Bitcoin's kind of that dollar, you know, in some ways policing the US dollar and also other currencies and nations around the world that have managed to keep US dollars out as kind of the alternative currency. So yeah,
that's a really interesting point about how, like, you know, the US dollar typically polices the, you know, all the other different currencies because it's so strong. And when it gets in there, you could actually start to exploit some of the weaknesses that are in that sovereign, the other country's sovereign currency. But now, either with capital controls and stuff, the US dollar is not allowed in, but it's very hard to have capital controls around Bitcoin. So Bitcoin actually becomes the police for all of these weak currencies. And, you know, you see, you know, with Bitcoin priced in Turkish lira, way above all-time high, priced in the Lebanese dollars, way above all-time high. So we're slowly going to start to see, you know, it just taking out all the all-time highs. But I want to transition from that, and I want to go specifically into what you are researching right now at blockchain.com. You know, as the head of research, what does your day look like? What sorts of problems are you tasked with being solved? And maybe even share some fun stories or some practical applications of how you guys have impacted the industry. I'm really curious.
So let me just briefly about blockchain.com, founded in 2011. So we're one of the old companies in the space, one of the oldest, well-known.
It's a great domain name.
It's the domain name. We started off as blockchain.info, well-known for our explorer, and became blockchain.com. Both have been great for search engine optimization traffic, you know, and so a lot of people discover crypto through the blockchain website. So there's kind of a special responsibility that I think the company feels to educating, and hence why someone like me is hired, you know, to kind of help provide reliable information, data to people who are new to the space. You know, a non-custodial wallet, that's our other flagship product, that, you know, is really, I think, important because it's true to kind of the original kind of crypto ethos, which we move further and further away from, I think, with more people not holding their own private keys, more people trusting exchanges. We have our own exchange. We think that's, you know, going to be the right product for a lot of people who aren't comfortable managing their private key. There is a lot of responsibility. You want the ultimate security and safety, you know, hold your private keys, but you also get the ultimate responsibility. You lose those, we can't recover your funds for you. We can't reset your private key. It's gone, you know, and so that's not something a lot of people, want to take on, at least yet, but we try to, you know, kind of get people more comfortable with that and really believe in that product. You know, so yeah, just trying to think back to, you know, your question about what I spend my time on, you know, at some point I'm going to want a medal from somebody for all the hours I've spent on the phone talking to media through the years explaining cryptocurrency. I got invited after the Cypriots decided to tax deposits in spring 2013 for the first time on television to explain Bitcoin. Sky News had me on. I've been fielding a lot of media requests since then. I love it. The media,
you're great at it.
most people don't come to the LSE or Cambridge to learn about anything. They learn about new things through the media. So the media has huge leverage, huge reach for educating people. And so I get way more leverage by talking to the media as an educator than I do in the classroom. So it's really worthwhile.
That's terrifying.
Well, it is what it is. And I've really been impressed in general with, you know, I think two of the unsung heroes in the story of crypto are media, who have really taken the time to get to know this space. Not all of them have, right? I mean, we can all think of you know, folks who've gotten this wrong. But also, you know, I don't want to get too off on another tangent, but I think regulators deserve some credit as well in many cases. Not all, but in many cases, I think they've created space for cryptocurrency to grow in a way that wasn't obvious to many people that they would do that. But anyway, spending time with regulators and media is something I spend a lot of time doing. In terms of current research topics, you know, I'm really thinking a lot these days. You know, I published some stuff recently on DeFi, but I'm really digging back into kind of voting technology with this election. I'm really getting a lot of kind of pips from folks in the political establishment who are wondering if we can do better. And there might be something to looking at digital identity, looking at, you know, some kind of blockchain-based voting system. This has been a technology that's, you know, blockchain and voting has been kind of dismissed. MIT just, you know, again, kind of dumped on it the other day. But I think a lot of people, correctly, in my view, see it as inevitable that we're going to have more electronic voting in one way, shape, or form, and we'll solve the security and usability challenges. And blockchain has a lot to offer potentially in terms of its principles and its, you know, is an inspiration for, I want to be able to audit my own vote. I want more transparency on the results. I want more reliability. I want a single source of truth, you know, that I can trust, a ledger accounting for what just happened that, you know, and we wrote about this in our recent monthly outlook. Even if you don't go and embrace blockchain for voting, the principles behind blockchain certainly can serve as inspiration, I think, for a better voting technology system.
Man, I could not agree more with that statement. That is really cool. And I just remember watching, this is like total side tangent, watching House of Cards back when it was still on. And they started talking about like blockchain-based voting. And like one of the guys got killed for talking about it because it's like, that's exactly what the government doesn't want. They don't want to give you full transparency and auditability. And, you know, everybody has an equal say and stuff. But it's totally necessary. So I got to go read the papers you've been writing on that. That's going to be really interesting. First money, then identity and voting and supply chain. And then the whole world is going to be on blockchain here pretty soon.
Hopefully anyway. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, Garrick, since you're doing a lot of research in crypto, we call the incentivization system of each network tokenomics. It's really important, but it's often misunderstood even by the developers, just how important it is. Can you give us an example of a project that has good tokenomics and why it makes it good versus a project that has maybe not so good tokenomics and why they're failing?
Yeah, that's one of the, I think, most interesting things I learned early on when I started going deeper and deeper into cryptocurrency, and it was at the financial cryptography and data security conferences that have been going for 20 plus years, highly recommend that even if you can't make it to these conferences, people look up the research of the financial cryptography and data security conferences. It's one of the best kept conference secrets in the world. Only a few hundred people go to it each year. But, you know, a lot of my intellectual heroes in financial cryptography have done really important presentations there. And you know, one of the things that Andrew Miller pointed out, I think at the first FC I went to in 2014, was how, you know, all the technical components of Bitcoin existed 10 years or more prior to the invention of Bitcoin. You know, the, you know, proof of work and the networking protocols and et cetera, right? What made Bitcoin special was what we call tokenomics, the incentives, you know, that kind of fashioned all this existing kind of off the shelf tech that Satoshi took and married together with a really, really, as it turns out, strong incentive system that works. And so when you ask me that question, what has the best tokenomics, you know, I'm going to kind of punt and say, I'm going to go with the Lindy effect. I'm going to go with the one that's been around the longest because that's the one that's been most battle tested and has stood up over time better than anything else so far. You know, what has bad tokenomics?
And before you move on real quick, I know that there's viewers out there that are going to say,
what, you know, they're searching on CoinMarketCap for Lindy effect right now. What he meant, Bitcoin has the Lindy effect, which means the longer a technology is in place, the more likely it is to sustain into the future. So do not go search for Lindy, search for BTC.
Yeah, don't fall for the Lindy token scam.
Yeah, I guarantee it's out there.
Guys, I've got a huge bag of Lindy tokens. Quit. You know, look, I'm a starving academic really at Harvard, so I was going to finally cash in.
That's great.
And then what's an example of some bad tokenomics?
Yeah, that's a trickier question. So obviously we've had a lot of coins fail, you know, and you've got zombie coins that are out there. You've got things that haven't really died completely, but, you know, maybe they're being propped up, you know, and still are on CoinMarketCap with some supposed, you know, fantasy market value. I mean, you know, that's what makes like Bitcoin dominance really hard to kind of calculate in some ways accurately, is what is the true market value as you get further and further down the leaderboard. I mean, as you do, I think you get into more fictional territory.
Absolutely.
And so dominance is probably higher than you know, a CoinMarketCap or, you know, CoinGecko would suggest, you know, but I guess, you know, I think I'm going to pick on an asset that actually we support, and I'm not going to come out and say they have bad tokenomics, but I think they had a problem, and that's Stellar. And this overhang of tokens that were held by the foundation, I think was problematic, for a number of reasons. Number one, that was like that kind of like big iceberg kind of, you knew that was sitting there with an explicit, kind of message that, hey, we're going to distribute these over time. And it was like 80%+ for a long, long time. So, you know, that really undermines kind of the store value kind of component, which is essential to having a medium of exchange. You know, you can't have a medium exchange that loses all its value. It's got to kind of balance those two things, right? And then it also, interestingly, I think created a regulatory problem or some regulatory risk because of this concern around, you know, how centralized something is, right? And is it sufficiently decentralized? That was the term that was used to characterize Ethereum, right? And so, you know, again, I'm not gonna say it's bad tokenomics. I think there are some problems that have been revealed through all these different, you know, experiments we've seen around different token structures. You know, we like Stellar. We think Stellar is actually one of the, you know, kind of more interesting, you know, blockchains and platforms out there. You know, and the mission is great, you know, wanting to solve the remittances cross-border payments issue, which has been just a huge kind of tax on people who really can't afford to be taxed on sending money back to grandma when they're working overseas, $200 chunks. You know, love that mission. But that structure created problems, I think, that is kind of, and they've tried to address it, of course, by, you know, burning. I think that's clear indication they kind of saw the writing on the wall there.
Yeah. And in October, they actually ceased all of their future inflation. I remember reading about it, and I saw a big, you know, green candlestick and then kind of just pittered out. But
and that's the beauty of this whole space, is we have all these wonderful live empirical experiments happening, you know, around tokenomics, around governance, you know, which ones are being embraced by the market, which ones are losing favor. You know, is there room to make adjustments? You know, we've seen, you know, adjustments made, you know, even, you know, things that people thought were inviolable. You think of the DAO hack on Ethereum. People thought that was the end of Ethereum. Obviously not. So there's definitely, you know, lots of interesting experiments going on that I think make this a really just amazing place for researchers like myself to study. You know, it's not theoretical. It's being battle tested in the market right now. And, you know, we'll see who wins.
I think Stellar was a great example for a great project that just needed some help with their tokenomics. Like you mentioned, they did their burn. They also did an airdrop to pretty much anyone who had a Keybase address to try and further decentralize their network. So they've come up with all kinds of different ideas.
I think I remember blockchain.com facilitated some of that airdrop too.
That's right. We actually, yeah, gave away over 100 million of XLM to, you know, a million plus of our users. It was our first major airdrop and the largest giveaway in history at that time, period. You know, not just a crypto airdrop, giveaway, period. And you know, I mean, Coinmetrics and Antoine over there, who used to work at blockchain.com, did some interesting analysis around, you know, what was the impact of that airdrop on price. And, you know, it hurt, you know, I mean, it's,
yeah,
you're handing out something to someone who may really be a BTC maximalist or something, and they're going to convert it instantly. And that's going to put downward pressure on the price. Right. I mean, that's
right.
The one of the takeaways again of this experimentation. But you know, we pick on Seller and XLM because, you know, Jed's an extraordinary entrepreneur and technologist. You know, is, and
you pick on it because, yeah, you know, it's not going away. You pick on it because it's kind of like, you know, he could take it.
Well, there's no disrespect.
I just had a visitor here.
That's quite all right.
Little baby Hilleman over there. That's no problem.
So before we get too far away, I want to circle back to Bitcoin for just a second. And can you explain why Bitcoin's tokenomics are really good in contrast to Stellar, that had that huge overhanging supply that was controlled by the one entity? You know, Bitcoin also did giveaways in its early days. But what is it about Bitcoin's tokenomics that make it so good? Is it the deflationary curve? What is it?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think we're still trying to figure this out. You know, it's you know, this experiment is playing out in real time. And some people who have tried to look into the future, an economist at the Bank of International Settlements published a paper with the term doomsday in the title describing Bitcoin's tokenomics. So it's a lot of debate around, you know, how good the tokenomics are. In our research, we did a blog post titled Battle Testing Bitcoin a few months back, where we looked at the halving and kind of projected into the future a bit about what the security budget of Bitcoin's tokenomics offers. And that's really what fundamentally I think we are getting at when we talk about, in the case of Bitcoin, at least, the tokenomics. How secure is the blockchain? Everything depends, in the case of Bitcoin, on its security. And I would argue pretty much every, you know, protocol and company, even in this space, a company like blockchain.com is nothing without security. It's our highest priority. And so when you think about the tokenomics of Bitcoin, you're thinking about, okay, what are those coins and transaction fees paying for? They're paying for security. And one thing we don't know is how much security Bitcoin needs. You know, the protocol has never been really, you know, kind of hacked in any way. So it's had sufficient security, but has it been overpaying? You know, has it been paying more for that security than it needs to? You know, and so when we look into the future, you know, if prices remain kind of where they are, I mean, security in my mind of the level we have today, even with, you know, future halvings in 4 years and the next 4 years and so on, is not a concern for another decade or more. You know, again, if today's security level is sufficient, we just don't know what is optimal security or sufficient security for sure. Other than when you think about it over time and say how much value has been at risk over a given amount of time and how much time has that value been at risk. And the longer more value has been at risk, the more confident you can be in the security of the system, in the quality of the tokenomic design. Right now, you know, it's working. And again, if today's security level is sufficient, then I expect it to continue to work for a decade or more. Will it continue to work in 100 years? No one knows for sure. Not even the top Bitcoin core developers will tell you candidly that it's a settled intellectual question that Bitcoin's tokenomics are perfect into perpetuity. You know, for the next decade or more, probably fine is our best guess right now.
And there still will be raging debate. I'm sure there's going to be more forks. I kind of liked what you said earlier about the religiosity of the whole space, because, you know, the Protestant Reformation was a fork from Catholicism and they have a different canon. So right when we're thinking about like Bitcoin, like all these different intellectual debates on security, you know, they're going to be contentious. And so that is one of the things that we'll just have to expect and get prepared for. But the last question we have for you before we move into a personal closing question, We've been looking at staking rewards lately on some proof of stake coins, and we're wondering kind of what is a good healthy inflation rate, just because, you know, we've seen some of these projects, you know, yield farming was a big thing and they were 200% APY, just insane. Price would skyrocket, everybody would be mining it, and then boom, it'd crash, go to zero. We've seen other coins like Tezos or Cosmos take a more conservative approach, much more conservative, but 6 to 8% a year. Is there a sweet spot, or what's really going on here?
That is, you know, at least a $1 billion question, right?
That's the $1 billion question. That's why we're asking the $1 billion man, right? The London School PhD.
I wish I was the $1 billion man. Not even remember, poor starving PhD student when I discovered Bitcoin, right? One thing, you know, I like about staking is you're playing a role in the security of the network. When you kind of put your coins into, you know, a staking system, and so it's one thing to loan your coins out, you know, and I think that's, you know, we have a great product, 12% interest rates on our US dollar stable coins. But you're not, when you do that, you're not contributing to the security of the system, right? In the same way that you're contributing to it when you stake, in many cases. And I think that's really interesting, because, you know, like the risk, of course, you know, with lending your coins out is, you know, Bitcoin, you know, historically has gone up, I think, something like 0.5% a day, you know, and it kind of puts your 3 or 6% you're earning on those coins, you know, in perspective, right? When you're talking about 0.5% a day.
Yeah, that's serious. You know,
And so, you know, but if you're staking, I mean, look, if you own a staking coin, you know, you're already exposed, you know, and to the, you know, so I don't know, there's some interesting alignment there around yield farming and yield generating that I think is interesting. I don't know is the short answer to your question though, what the optimal level is. I think, you know, it may be a lot lower than we think, because again, we talked about how only 5% of the US population we think owns crypto assets roughly. So, you know, this whole space, as it continues to grow, is probably going to see appreciation, you know, and so you're getting kind of print, you know, appreciation in the principal, you know, how much yield do you really need, you know, to kind of like supplement that possibility to attract
That's a great point.
Stakers, right? I mean, maybe not that much, you know, I think it's really, you know, again, security is paramount, right? Exchanges have been hacked, wallets have been hacked, you know, individual users have been hacked. These protocols themselves, the biggest ones, Bitcoin, Ethereum, you know, really have not been hacked. That is crucial. That's what everything rests on, you know, and it's critical that they be maintained.
One of the most fascinating financial experiments, which is really my favorite way to describe this industry now, a financial experimental forum, really. Pundi X is this ICO that was in, I think, 2017 or 2018. People were super excited about it at first. It had a very thriving ecosystem. They had these point of service sale things where you could spend all kinds of different cryptocurrencies on them. And then they decided they were going to, I don't know if they decided out of nowhere or if it was originally part of the plan, but they inflated their supply like 3 times. Like at one point there was like 268 billion tokens, and it crashed the price down from a penny to less than 1/1000th of a penny. And people were just losing their minds, even though they got airdrops. They did airdrops for 2 years as they devalued their currency as radically as they possibly could. And then at the end of the airdrops, they start burning tokens with every transaction to burn down the entire inflation over however many years it takes, while continuing to do more things to make their ecosystem thriving. They got this really cool blockchain phone now, all kinds of interesting stuff they're doing, but it's potentially like the best buying opportunity or like dice roll that I've ever seen. Like, I'm not sponsored by them, but I mean, literally for like $100, you could buy like 1 million tokens And if this gets anywhere back to where it already was before, I mean, it's almost laughable.
Long shot.
Very, very long shot and long tail. I mean, this thing could take, if it's around in 10, 15
the
years.
The Poon DX is the perfect example of the euthanasia roller coaster. That's what yeah. that is.
It is. It's going to shake out every weak hand that doesn't see the long-term vision. But I met the founder of this guy in Singapore. He used to work for Google. He's a brilliant dude who had this 10, 15, 20-year vision. And if he pulls it off, it's going to be absolutely incredible. But it is an experiment.
On that note, we have one final question. This is a question we like to ask everybody who ever comes on the podcast. And it is a pretty simple one. And it's just, if this was the first podcast that anybody was listening to, just hearing about crypto for the first time, they say, wow, cool title, London School of Economics, old investment banker, head of research. I want to listen to this. What's the one takeaway?
The one takeaway, I think if you're really new, get off zero, and own a little bit of crypto. It's something you can intellectualize and research like crazy. But until you actually, hold crypto and ideally transact it, send it, you really can't know it. It really does make a big difference. You can hold the tiniest amount of crypto. You can get it for free through airdrops and other things in many cases. But just try it, because it is, I think, now clear. I think post 2017, it was made clear, especially, that this isn't going away. This is going to be a part of our financial future one way or another. And, it's going to be helpful for you to kind of get your hands dirty playing around with crypto in some way, shape, or form.
Couldn't agree more. It's great, great wisdom from a vet in the industry. Garrick, we couldn't thank you enough for your time. We thank you so, so, so much for all the work that you're doing and to continue to be a champion. So without further ado, we'll talk to you soon. Aaron, I'll see you later on today.
Yes, sir. Thanks, Garrick.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Later, guys.